Hello, this is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This week's Triangle Business Journal is entitled Staying Connected. It's a special report. The focus is on mentoring Monday. So we'll get to more of that later. Let's open the Triangle Journal. And what do we find on the biz page? Well, under the heading of Winter Wonderland, we have North Carolina slopes are busy. The pandemic hasn't stopped skiers from heading to the North Carolina slopes. The ski season has been very good so far for the area ski resorts, says Wright Tilley, executive director of the Boone and Watauga County Tourism Development Authority. The week of Christmas and the week between Christmas and New Year's was booked solid. Hawk's Nest Snow Tubing Resort was also sold out those weeks. The resorts also had similar experiences during the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend. Most of the ski resorts and Hawk's Nest were sold out of available time slots in advance of the weekend. The Cataloochee Ski Area, north of Waynesville, sold out of day passes for February the 13th and said it was experiencing unprecedented call volume. The North Carolina Ski Association recorded 531,241 skiers and snowboarders for the 2019-2020 winter season, and the state's resorts had gross revenue of $49 million. That was up from 607,547 skiers and snowboarders and $42.8 million in gross revenue in 2018-2019. And next on the biz page for this week, under the heading of Methodist Home, Gala Goes Virtual Raises Big Amount. One of Raleigh's major galas was a virtual success this year. The Methodist Home for Children usually hosts a Winter's Tale in Raleigh and similar events in Wilmington and Greenville. This year, it held the virtual An Evening to Dream Big on January the 30th. The idea was to help children dream of what they could become. The Reverend Bruce Stanley, president and CEO of the Methodist Home, reminded the crowd that many children do not see a life beyond tomorrow, and dreams include hoping to live to the age of 40 or to see mom. We know we can't change what has happened to these kids. We cannot change their past, but we can change their future, he said. The event, hosted by WRAL's Deborah Morgan, raised $503,000. And under the heading of travel, drop in traffic at RDU mimics the national trend. Traffic plummeted 66% at Raleigh-Durham International Airport in 2020, but at least the airport wasn't alone as the pandemic gutted travel across the country. According to the International Air Transport Association, demand fell globally by 65.9%, the sharpest traffic decline in aviation history. And there's a little bar graph associated with this article that says, here's how RDU compared to some of the airports around the country in 2020. So we have RDU Airport was down 66%, as mentioned earlier. Kansas City was down 64%. Austin, Texas, down 63%. Milwaukee, down 62%. Atlanta, down 60%. Phoenix down 53%, Denver down 51%, and Charlotte down 46%. Also on the biz page, under the heading of Law Center, comes the article, NCCU getting major support from Intel. Intel, one of Silicon Valley's leading technology companies, is giving $5 million over 5 years to NC Central University to create a new tech law and policy center and build a jobs pipeline for NCCU law school graduates. In addition to the dollars, executives from Intel will take on new roles with the Durham School. Intel, based in Santa Clara, California, has 110,000 employees worldwide, and its only North Carolina office is Cary, where it has roughly 50 employees. We were looking to make a significant donation to a historically black college or university, and particularly one with a law school, says Steve Rogers, who is Intel's executive vice president and general counsel. NCCU students will engage directly with Intel executives who will serve as guest lecturers and mentors. Two first-year law students will also join a summer associate program with Intel. Our goal is, and what we see eye to eye with NCC on, is to give more access to diverse professionals, especially in the legal field, Rogers says. Law school dean Brown Lewis says, the gift will enable us to expand our technology and law footprint. We will be able to provide our students with the skills they need to navigate the changing legal landscape, to start a pipeline program to increase the number of students of color entering the tech law field, and to advocate for policies that will help reduce the inequitable distribution of technology in the country. And finally, on this week's biz page, the article, Music Firm Sees Rising Interest. A Hillsboro company is quietly becoming a force in the music industry and is getting some significant recognition from Governor Roy Cooper's office. COVID-19 hit the music industry hard, but the shut-in nature of the pandemic led to rising interest in listening to music at home, lifting Red Eye Worldwide to be the e-commerce winner for the 2020 Governor's Export Awards. Red Eye is a traditional music distribution company that oversees the sales and marketing needs of our record label partners for both their digital and physical releases, says Hank Stockard, Red Eye's Business Development Director. The ability to deliver physical CDs and vinyl LPs to customers safely and efficiently at both the wholesale and direct-to-consumer level drives our physical business. On the digital side, too, there was more interest in streaming and downloading. Connecting fans with amazing independent music, either digitally or physically, is our primary goal at Red Eye, Stockard says. Glenn Dicker and Tom Hansen founded the firm in Carrboro in 1996. Later moved to Haw River, and took over a former Southern Season warehouse in Hillsboro in 2016. Stockard says Red Eye has grown to 125 employees overall, with about 85 based in Hillsboro. Stockard isn't releasing any revenue numbers, but Red Eye's growth was enough to catch the eye of the state. Next, we turn to a page entitled News. And it is related to a very local spot, and that is NC Mutual remain an iconic Durham spot. A historic but financially troubled company in Durham will remain in its longtime headquarters after talks with the iconic building's new owner resulted in an amended lease agreement. When New York-based investment firm Turnbridge Equities bought the landmark tower at Mutual Plaza in a foreclosure auction last year, there was a lot it didn't know about the property, but it definitely didn't expect that its premier tenant was looking to nullify its lease for the top floor. The 14-story tower hit the auction block last year after the previous owners defaulted on payments. Turnbridge Equities entered the auction last fall, paying $37.2 million for the foreclosed property in October. Around the same time, its top floor tenant, North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance, filed a motion to vacate its 11,909-square-foot lease in the building. The company, which has occupied the building for 53 years, has been under state-controlled rehabilitation since late 2018. Turnbridge found out about the petition to reject the lease shortly after the auction closed. We knew NC Mutual was going through receivership and going through hardship, says Jason Davis, managing director with Turnbridge Equities. What we didn't know was that they had filed a motion to reject their lease through the court-appointed receiver. That was certainly a surprise to us. The company reached out to NC Mutual to begin talks around potentially modifying the lease to keep the long-term tenant. NC Mutual built the building in 1968 as its headquarters tower, but has downsized its presence in the tower in recent years. Last year, the company was down to just one whole floor at the top of the tower, and much of that was used for storage. It turned out they didn't need the whole floor, Davis said, so they relocated lower down in the building to a smaller suite and relocated their storage to the basement. The move kept the company in the property and slashed its costs by around 75%. I think this is a win-win, Davis says. We can do right by NC Mutual. NC Mutual, one of the state's most prominent African-American businesses, currently takes up 3,355 square feet on the third floor of the 180,000-square-foot building with a current occupancy of 56%. Other tenants in the building include Duke University, Duke Health, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and an architecture firm, Perkins & Will. Turnbridge is planning a multi-million-dollar renovation of the building. Now we turn the page in this week's Triangle Business Journal to the OnTech EcoDevo page. And the major article on this page is named Targeting Pests. AgTech adds cash to grow. Nearly 2 years after moving its headquarters from Kalamazoo, Michigan to the Triangle, AgTech firm Vesteron Corporation has added $18.3 million to its coffers. CEO Anna Rath says the round raised in the midst of a global pandemic was massively oversubscribed. At the end of the day, it's a testament to the market traction we had this year and our first full year of commercialization, she says. Vesteron has released what it calls SPEAR, a peptide that targets four major greenhouse pests, aphids, spider mites, thrips, and whiteflies. According to its website, it controls the pests as efficiently as conventional insecticides and with the safety and sustainability of biologicals, and has an excellent safety profile for pollinators such as honeybees. The new funding infusion will allow the firm to push the product internationally, and it will also support plans to submit a second peptide for registration later this year, which could soon lead to the firm's second product line. Vesteron moved its corporate headquarters to Research Triangle Park in 2019, hoping to benefit from the region's talent pool. At the time, Rath said Vesteron would benefit from being around the venture-backed AgTech, the major AgTech companies in the space. Now she says that's exactly what happened. When she joined the firm just under 3 years ago, it was solely an R&D team in Michigan. I didn't want to do anything to disrupt that team, but I also needed to turn Vesteron into a fully functional organization, she says. It was just clear to me that it was going to be much easier to attract the kind of talent that I needed to build the organization out in a place like RTP that has such a strong ecosystem. The raise disclosed recently came from 16 investors, according to a securities filing. And by the numbers, they have three little bits of information here about Triangle AgTechs that have added cash in 2021. So pairwise, a Durham gene editing firm in an equity round raised $90 million. Vestaron, a company I've just read about, in their equity round, raised $18.3 million. And finally, Vendara, a Durham plant-focused analytics firm, raised $1.9 million. Finally, on this page, under the heading of Life Sciences, sector promising for Wake County. With two big project wins in Gilead Sciences and PennyMac, Wake County is off to a banner start in 2021, and it really could just be the start, according to the county's top economic development recruiter. TBJ asked Michael Haley, executive director of Wake County Economic Development, for his insights. How big is Wake County's pipeline in terms of recruiting and expanding companies? His answer, we're leading 43 active projects at present. And that pipeline, what sector is showing the most interest? Haley's answer, the life sciences sector remains the most active in terms of number of policies, capital investment, and jobs. And now we turn the page in today's Triangle Business Journal, and under the heading of New Direction, we have the article Raleigh Project Moves Club. A comedy club in Raleigh is set to make way for a new apartment project tucked between Glenwood South and the NC State University campus. A Raleigh developer has filed plans to bring a large mixed-use apartment building up to seven stories tall to the site that currently hosts Goodnight's Comedy Club, across from Irregardless Cafe. Developer AGM Partners has filed plans with the city for 865 Morgan, calling for 401 apartments and 9,000 square feet of retail in a building 4 to 7 stories tall. The project is situated on about 3 acres at 865 West Morgan Street. It's a neat opportunity for someone to live close to downtown, and just an 8-minute walk to the Warehouse District and Glenwood South, says Greg Sandroider, managing partner at HM Partners, which is behind the Edison Lofts on East Davie Street and Edison Sky House, a 23-story apartment building on South Blunt Street. For 865 Morgan, filings with the city call for 297 one-bedroom apartments and 104 two-bedroom units. The building's stories will vary based on the topography, from 4 stories at the highest elevation to 7 at the lowest. Amenities will include 2 courtyards, according to plans. Filings also include a structured parking deck with 513 spaces. HM Partners hasn't locked down any retail tenants, but Sandroider says he expects the retail space to feature some food and beverage uses. Altogether, the development would total 438,856 square feet of space, a major uptick from the existing 24,860 currently slated for demolition if the plans move ahead. Sandroider confirms that the development will mean the demolition and replacement of the decades-old building at 861 West Morgan Street, home to Goodnight's Comedy Club, which continues to operate. He says HM Partners and Goodnight's reached an agreement, and that Goodnight's will continue at another location. Goodnight's management did not respond to requests for comment, and it was unclear whether the company has determined where they might move the business. HM Partners plans to begin work on the site this quarter and hopes to have site approval by the summer. A rezoning is not needed for the development. Next, we turn to a page that is entitled Around the State, and it features two major articles, one from the Charlotte Business Journal and one from the Triad Business Journal. So we'll start with the article from Charlotte Business entitled Growth Ahead for Charlotte's Core. Charlotte's center city, like most downtowns, feels like a ghost town these days. Office workers continue to work virtually. Restaurants are operating on reduced hours or have closed permanently, and venues such as Bank of America Stadium and Blumenthal Performing Arts Center are quiet. Despite all that, there's reason for hope looking ahead, says Michael Smith, president and CEO of Charlotte Center City Partners. I think there's a pretty big opportunity for Charlotte to differentiate itself, he says. The latest annual economic development report by CCCP details growth and development and what's coming in Uptown, South End, and Midtown. And while there's still no certainty on when office workers will be back or when restaurants can operate at full capacity, the hope among many is a return to some degree of normal before year's end. In the Center City, $3 billion in development is planned in 2021, according to that report. That includes 3.9 million square feet of office space, 2,020 hotel rooms, 552,000 square feet of retail, and 5,505 apartments. Some of that is in planning stage and hasn't broken ground, but the numbers represent real projects in Center City's pipeline. The report provides some insight into how companies are thinking about the future of the office, too. Based on a CBI survey included, 95% of polled organizations said they would keep their offices open to employees, and 33% are planning to make at least minor changes to their spaces to allow for social distancing. About 40% of Center City workers are in finance and insurance, real estate and leasing, and professional scientific and technical services. Those industries have historically been heavy users of office space. There are now more than 17,000 workers in South End, according to the report. That's, of course, when people are actively working in offices. Smith says there are still some institutional investors interested in Charlotte, citing record-setting land and building sales that have occurred even during the pandemic. And while some are speculating about a shift away from the urban core in a post-pandemic world, he believes Charlotte's Center City will come back, even if there are changes in how people work. I think there will be changes in the way that we see office space, and companies are beginning to develop strategies for that, Smith says. There have been pandemics throughout the centuries of humankind, and cities continue to be restored as incredibly important central business districts and centers of commerce. In 2020, CCCP took the helm of supporting small businesses in Uptown and surrounding neighborhoods as many of them saw overnight disappearance of revenue, first from stay-at-home workers, then as remote work became prolonged. In partnership with philanthropic and corporate partners, CCCP launched a small business innovation fund to help provide grants to help businesses stay afloat. So far, 116 small businesses in three rounds have received grants, Smith says. And then from the Triad Business Journal comes an educational story regarding High Point University. High Point University debuts new library as university grows. On February the 16th, High Point University announced that it will build an $80 million library as part of its 10-year $1 billion growth plan. The four-story, 150,000-square-foot library is expected to be completed by 2024, which is the university's 100th anniversary. It will become the main library on campus and will be supplemented by several existing satellite libraries on campus. The new library will include textbooks, digital databases, private study spaces, and an art gallery of historical artifacts. The new building will also house a new admissions center. Even during the pandemic, we welcomed our largest total enrollment and largest graduate student enrollment in university history, HPO President Nito Cubain says. The University Admissions Center will be housed in the facility in order to welcome potential students and families on campus tours, admissions events, and scholarship interviews. HPU's growth plan was announced in September of 2019, and $700 million of the commitment will go towards scholarships for students from diverse backgrounds, first-generation college students, and veterans. This week's Triangle Business Journal switches things around a little bit, and as a response to that, I'm going to next read the page containing the executive voice. This week's executive voice belongs to Marshall Ridge. Here's the article. For more than 15 years, real estate broker Marshall Rich has grown his boutique firm, Rich Realty Group, through national downturns and now a global pandemic, steadily building his expertise in Raleigh's inside the Beltline market and filling out a roster of brokers in one of the hottest markets in the country. Today, the company does business throughout the Triangle, but Rich says the bulk of that work is in Raleigh. Rich Realty has a roster of 8 brokers plus support staff and plans for additional growth. Rich was exposed to real estate early on watching the family business before striking out on his own in Raleigh. I grew up as my dad was running a real estate company in Little Washington, North Carolina, Rich said. So I grew up around real estate, and after college, got my real estate license in 1999 and started working for Fondle Morrissey Building Group. Rich studied business communication at UNC Chapel Hill, and after Fondle, he saw a 2-year stint as a radio sales rep before getting back into real estate in 2002. He launched his own firm in 2004. Those were busy times as the real estate bubble continued to grow. In the early 2000s, I'd say from 2002 to 2007, it felt like a straight-up climb, he says. There were people that would buy homes and 2 months later sell them for chunky profits. Fortunately, that's not happening now. Those years were crazy. Then in 2008, the recession hit. That didn't stop Rich from adding his first additional broker that year, however, and for the next few years, the company carved out business where it could. We slowly grew. It was really organic, he said. I never thought I'd have any sort of shop. The firm continued brokering sales. Rich says his firm also built a niche in residential short sales as homeowners around the region found themselves unable to make payments and stuck with a house worth less than the balance on the loan. That was a weird time, he says. It was around 2012 that we started to see some light. And at that time, the builders started to buy again and were buying profusely. Rich and his expanding group soon found themselves busy brokering land sales for developers and brokering home sales as growth returned. For the next 8 years, that growth only accelerated as more companies and people moved to the Triangle and home builders scrambled to keep up. Then the pandemic hit and buyers around the country hit the brakes, but only briefly. Those first 2 weeks were a little scary, Rich says. People were calling and asking if we should cancel their contracts. By summer, demand for new homes and developable lots was booming yet again. And by the fall, supply was starting to run out, especially North Hills and ITB. Inventory is down, and total closed sales are up. It almost doesn't make sense, Rich said at the time. We're closing more homes with less inventory. Brokers found homeowners hesitant to show homes amid a pandemic. Homeowners also face the challenge of selling and then having to buy. It's really tough if you have to sell to buy, he says. I've even had people sell their house, collect their equity, and rent Airbnb until they can buy what they want. Trying to time it up is tough. Meanwhile, homes and available land that do become available are often the subject of intense bidding wars, especially in Raleigh. Anything under $500,000, it's very competitive. I personally had a home with over 30 offers on it this month, Rich says. People are still wanting to be in and around downtown Raleigh. North Hills is also incredibly hot. Meanwhile, home builders are struggling to find land to keep up with demand for new homes in Raleigh. Even pre-pandemic, larger plots were becoming harder to come by. Amid all this, Rich says he's considering options to grow the farm further. We want to grow our volume, but sustainably, not growing for the sake of growing, he says. Meanwhile, realty firms have felt the need to continue adding support for brokers, adding digital tools and advertising to traditional roles. Social media is a big change in real estate. That's kind of must-have for real estate brokers, Rich says. But the basics will always rule the day. It's just a matter of representing the client. And as we turn the page, we get to the special report on Mentoring Monday that I talked about earlier. The subtitle for this article is Mentoring in This Moment. Empathy, humility, connecting, and not just professionally, on a personal level. The challenges for women who wish to help lift others have never been greater or more necessary to overcome. And this article consists of about four smaller articles written by various and sundry people who are involved in this mentoring project. And we begin by talking about Leanne Nance. Leanne Nance, the chief operating officer at Raleigh-based Stewart Design and Engineering firm, learned early in her career how mentoring goes beyond just teaching professional goals. Over the course of my career, mentors have taught me that your character will be your legacy, Nance says. People may forget what you did on certain projects, but they will remember your character. A mentor said, it does not matter what happened to make you lose control. People will only matter, remember the reaction, and that you can follow, and they can follow you through your career. To this day, when I face tough situations, I still think about how she would handle it. Nance was earning her master's degree when she found a mentor who was one of the few women working in the Fortune 100 financial world in the mid-1980s. She became Nance's role model and started the difficult discussions that later would help Nance reach her potential. She cared enough about me to provide both constructive and positive feedback, Nance says. She did not have time to invest in me with courageous conversations, but she did anyway. It's easy for a mentor to tell you what you're doing right, but a strong mentor relationship is really about helping you grow and learn from their experiences, so you do not have to go through them, or if you do, you can navigate them more smoothly. Like Nance, hundreds of local women in business continue to apply what they have learned through mentorship to run major companies while helping other women, even amid the pandemic. They highlight the importance of prioritizing mentorship and how being a mentor or becoming a mentee can have life-changing results. Now we get to a couple of the smaller pieces of this cover story. And one is entitled, How Does Having a Mentor Help People Find Their Purpose? And this article is written by Michelle Blackman, who happens to be program coordinator at Wake Technical Community College. It was important for me to have someone who is in my corner because not everyone wants what's best for you. My mentor is that person who celebrates with me when I reach a goal or cheers me up when I'm feeling down. They also are there to help me reach my goals. My mentor keeps me motivated and encouraged. But also, she's someone who will be honest with me if she feels I'm heading in the wrong direction, and she will help to get me back on track. It's an opportunity for both the mentor and mentee to grow, because throughout the process, both will learn from each other. It's important for individuals in the workplace to have an open mind about the process and understand that it's okay to be mentored by someone who you may not have anything in common with. You'll find that having someone who is not like you will give you a different perspective in the workplace and in life. Also, if you have multiple mentors, it allows you to see different perspectives. And next in our cover story article comes the article, What Are Some of the Best Approaches to Take When Finding a Mentor? And this one is authored by Anuja Pirawit, who happens to be Vice President and Assistant General Counsel at RTI International in Research Triangle Park. Look at what your company offers and try to match yourself up with someone who is already doing something that you'd like to do years from now. Take a proactive step. Take that leap. It always isn't easy, but you should go for it. A lot of people at my stage of their career want to give back or pay it forward. It doesn't have to be this painful, ongoing process. You can learn a lot from someone even with a lunch or conversation over coffee. If there's someone who you want to cultivate a relationship, take your time and get to know that person. I should also tell you that coupled in this main article is a virtual program called Mentoring Monday that occurs on February 22nd. And it is a virtual program. And if you want to register, you go to bizjournals.com/triangle/event. Once again, that's bizjournals.com/triangle/event. Now, continuing with our special report, we come to the next article, which asks the question, what has your mentor said or done that resonates with you to this day? And the author for this is Leanne Nance, Chief Operating Officer at Stewart here in Raleigh. I found courage and peace of mind as my mentors taught me that we're all human and we're going to make mistakes. But what we do when we make mistakes is where character comes in. They showed me how to give myself and others grace. They taught me how to learn from my mistakes, make it right if possible, apply the lesson learned, and move on. Now we're back to Anuja Purohit for another short article answering the question, why should companies facilitate mentorship in the workplace? To have a strong and sustainable organization, you need to pay it forward by investing in your people. For me, it's the biggest pleasure to be part of the Women's Advancement, Leadership, and Success Employee Resource Group at RTI. It's really enriched my life to watch diverse young women leaders emerge and find a community where they can feel supported. Someone who looked very different from me opened the doors to my career and had entirely different experiences than me. For that person to have done that for me early on in my career was a gift. The biggest gift is to be able to give it back. And we need everyone to be part of this. Men can help women. In most cases, males are at the top of the organizations. But we need to build bridges to people in leadership, even if they may be different. And another short article here answering the question, how should women in leadership approach being a mentor? And this article is authored by Tracy Woody, who is the Executive Vice President of Protagonist Therapeutics, based in Chapel Hill. I will start my advice with a quote attributed to American author Joseph Campbell. The cave you fear to enter holds the treasure you seek. Personally speaking, the caves that I feared have been the role that seems too big, the areas where I had little experience, or the jobs that required the most sacrifice. Those endeavors were not always successful. Thankfully, some were, but they were the ones who ended up giving me the most fulfilling and allowed me to grow the most. I think, like a lot of female leaders, I often feel overwhelmed and exhausted. To tackle those feelings, I've set a few non-negotiables. One example is driving my son to school each morning. I work primarily on West Coast hours, and one benefit is that I get to drive my son to school. There are very few days that I allow my work to take that spot. Finally, engage your colleagues in tough conversations, but also be kind. Courageous but kind participation attracts positivity. When you courageously take on a challenge, and when you allow others to do the same, good things will happen. And this week's Triangle Business Journal has this neat little article entitled The State of Life Sciences in North Carolina. Each year, the North Carolina Biotechnology Center updates its statistics on the life sciences industry in the Tar Heel State. The latest roundup from the Durham-based Life Sciences Economic Development Organization paints a robust picture of the industry in the state. So here, from the North Carolina Biotech Center, are a few key data points. And we'll just start with numbers and then explain them. So by the numbers, 775. There are 775 life sciences companies currently operating in North Carolina. 67,000. The life sciences industry accounts for more than 67,000 North Carolina jobs. 2,500. There are nearly 2,500 life sciences support companies in the Old North State, including such categories as health services and wellness. Now, some dollar figures. $84 billion. The life sciences industry accounts for $84 billion in total annual economic activity and roughly 224,000 total jobs that stem from direct, indirect, and induced life sciences activity. And one more dollar sign, $97,000. The average job salary in the life sciences industry in North Carolina is $97,000 plus. And last from this Biotechnology Center report comes a little snippet called Vaccine Tracker. There were about 1.8 million total COVID-19 vaccinations doled out in North Carolina from December 14th of 2020 through February 15th of this year, according to the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Here's a quick breakdown of first dose at vaccine administration in the three largest counties in the Triangle during that time period. So we're looking at 1.12 million first dose vaccines. In Orange County, 24,057. In Durham, 42,139. And finally, in Wake, 113,374. Next in this week's Triangle Business Journal comes the A Better World page, which is a bunch of articles on the Triangle's nonprofit scene. And the first one is under the heading of Clear Information, entitled Nonprofits, Businesses Can Be Key Messengers in the Pandemic. The pandemic has taken a toll on the Triangle's nonprofits. About half of North Carolina nonprofits have experienced an increase in demand for their services over the past year, according to a survey from the North Carolina Center for Nonprofits and the North Carolina Office of Strategic Partnerships. Record numbers of North Carolinians are seeking help at food banks, crisis assistance centers, affordable housing providers, community health centers, and domestic violence agencies. At the same time, many nonprofits have fewer financial resources and personnel. More than three-fourths of participants in the nonprofit survey lost revenue last year, and fewer people are volunteering. Nationally, nonprofit employment is down by 7.4% since the beginning of the pandemic, according to a recent report from the Center for Civil Society Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Arts organizations, social services providers, educational nonprofits, and faith-based organizations have suffered the most job losses. It would be easy for nonprofits simply to give up by cutting back on services or closing their doors. Fortunately, most nonprofits have chosen the opposite approach. Over the past couple of months, many nonprofits have taken on a new and important role: public health information providers. Nonprofits are trusted messengers, and many people are likely to take important public health actions if the message comes from a familiar nonprofit. Nonprofits are working to speed up the return to pre-COVID life by spreading clear and accurate information about vaccines, masks, and social distancing to their staffs, volunteers, clients, and communities. Business leaders are also understandably ready for a safe resumption of normal operations. Like nonprofits, businesses have captive audiences with their employees, clients, and customers, so they can also be effective messengers about stopping the spread of COVID-19. Here are some of the public health resources that nonprofits are sharing with their communities. First, information about vaccines. As vaccines arrive, it is increasingly important to dispel myths about vaccination and to provide clear information about receiving vaccines. Many North Carolinians remain skeptical about COVID-19 vaccines, either because of distrust of government or because of historical misuse of vaccinations for experimentation in communities of color. 20% of respondents to a recent Elon University poll said they would not get vaccinated, and another 24% were unsure. It will be difficult for the Triangle to achieve herd immunity and a return to normalcy unless a growing number of North Carolinians are vaccinated. Nonprofits and businesses can help increase vaccination rates by explaining to their staff, clients, and customers that the vaccines are tested, safe, and effective. The NC Department of Health and Human Services has easy-to-share information on its vaccine resources page. With the process for administering vaccinations in constant flux, it's also important for nonprofits and businesses to share accurate information with the majority of Triangle residents who want to be vaccinated. Right now, providers are offering vaccinations to adults who are 65 and older and to health care workers. Starting on February 24th, teachers and child care workers will be eligible. However, many people who now qualify or will soon qualify are not yet aware they can receive the vaccine, do not know that it is free, and or do not know how to get one. Nonprofits and businesses are ideally positioned to bridge this knowledge gap. The DHHS Vaccine Resources page has updated online tools for anyone can find my group to help learn when they will be eligible to get their vaccine and to find my spot to locate vaccine providers near where they live and work. DHHS also has a bilingual vaccine help center, which is available by phone at 888-675-4567. Let me repeat that number, 888-675-4567. And finally, reminders about other measures. Vaccinations alone won't eliminate the spread of COVID-19. Throughout the pandemic, NCDHHS has emphasized the importance of wearing a mask, waiting 6 feet apart, and washing your hands. Nonprofits and businesses can be strong messengers about the importance of sticking with these practices by sharing regular reminders and new information, like the recent CDC guidance on proper fitting and layering of masks. Organizations can even give free supplies of masks to their employees and volunteers and distribute sanitizing supplies and protective equipment through their communities. Also, another little article here on the Better World page, under the heading of Charitable Program, the article is entitled Raleigh Jeweler Continues Giving. Bailey's Fine Jewelry donated more than $64,000 to local charities in 2020 through its charitable program called A Time to Give. The program provides customers with a complimentary watch battery replacement and, in exchange, requests a donation be made to that month's designated charity. The program dates to 2008, and Bailey's has donated more than $729,000 to nonprofits in Raleigh, Rocky Mount, and Greenville. Our family is so blessed to be able to live and work in such amazing communities, and it's an honor to be able to give back to them, said Trey Bailey of Bailey's Fine Jewelry. 2020 was a hard year for everyone, and we're grateful we were able to support these organizations. Now we find ourselves on the edit viewpoint page of this week's Triangle Business Journal, and our editor has authored the article, Housing Market Presents Dilemma for Agents. The idea of writing this column came on a golf course playing with a few of my buddies. One of them is moving out of town and will put his house on the market in North Raleigh up for sale. He said something that was surprising. He's going to list his house on his own and is preparing a website for it. I knew there were a lot of sellers in the past who chose the self-listing route to make the most out of a purchase price, but for my friend, it was more than that. He knows he can sell his house because of the ridiculous housing market we have, where demand has completely outstripped the supply, amid historic low mortgage interest rates and showing no signs of abatement. My friend believes he will have tons of showings immediately after he posts his for sale sign in his front yard. Then he will let his next door social community know of his intentions. He will put up the website links on the Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn feeds and wait. If the market remains like this, there may be more and more sellers willing to do that on their own. Local real estate data show more and more homes and a specific price range, that's $400,000 and under, are getting more showings and more offers, with many of them over the asking price. But will the same homes get as much attention without employing a seller's side agent? Doubtful, but you don't need 10 or 15 offers. You just need one or two. And if one happens to be over the asking price, chances are a seller would be just as happy. Real estate agents would argue the industry has been successful for a reason. Many agents come with tons of experience, and they're able to lower the stress level for most buyers and sellers. That argument may just not be enough if mortgage interest rates stay at levels where they are, and people continue to move into our communities. Yet new home starts continue to meander at an anemic pace. Real estate agents will need a new strategy, and not only because the dynamics of the Triangle housing market have changed dramatically, but because of increased pressure from Washington, D.C., and some courts. Mortgage News Daily's Jan Swanson writes, over the last few months, there has been some legal activity, mostly directed at multiple listing services, that's known as MLS, of course, the entities that aggregate and display listings of homes for sale. These actions are aimed at determining how real estate sales commissions are established and shared, and how this may limit competition. The North Carolina Real Estate Commission believes there are some 100,000 licensed commercial and residential real estate brokers in the state. And the Triangle NCREC's Janet Thorin says complaints against brokers have gone up in the past year as prospective home buyers are filing complaints against their agents because their bids for houses were not successful. Across the country, the National Association of Realtors estimates there are some 1.4 million individuals in the real estate business. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, BLS, estimates there are 477,200 real estate brokers and sales agents in the country. Also troubling for the industry is that the BLS has already come up with some soft predictions about the sector. The BLS estimates that between 2019 and 2029, only 11,300 additional jobs will be created in the sector, down from its initial 10-year estimate of 20,000. Further, the government estimates a lukewarm 2% growth in job outlook, substantially lower than many industries. This hot housing market is not helping one of its own, one of its oldest and most prominent job creators. The guest columnist this week on the editor's page is John Hood, who's chairman of the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. His article is entitled, Higher Cost Won't Help the Economy. If you think the cost of living is too low, I bear good tidings. The Biden administration and its allies in Congress, regulatory agencies, and state governments across the country are working nonstop to raise the cost of food, shelter, energy, and education. Help is on the way. Embedded in President Biden's proposed COVID-19 relief package, for example, is a hike in the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Even if phased in over several years, such a pronounced increase in labor costs can't be absorbed by restaurants, retailers, and other tight-margin service industries as lower returns. Investment capital would flow elsewhere, and small enterprises in particular would simply become unprofitable. So inescapably, a boost in the wage to $15 an hour will mainly give some low-skill workers a pay boost at the expense of others getting a pay cut to $0 an hour. Their jobs will be supplanted by kiosks or other technology. Most of the remaining financial hit will show up as higher consumer prices. What about shelter? I recognize that many progressives who staff federal, state, and local agencies are genuinely concerned about affordable housing. Unfortunately, the regulations and other policies they espouse would have the effect of making it more expensive to build the housing stock consumers desire. If businesses can't supply new homes to middle-class and affluent buyers, the older homes these buyers would have vacated won't be available for folks of modest means to rent or buy. Energy? The Biden administration has an explicit goal of raising the cost of electricity and transportation by heavily taxing or regulating fossil fuels. Yes, if natural gas and motor fuels are more expensive, consumers would be willing to shift to other options. I do think we should take the long-term consequences of climate change seriously. But right now, without affordable and reliable alternatives, such as next-generation nuclear power, the inevitable effect of hiking energy costs will be to make goods much more expensive to produce and to deliver by truck, train, or ship. On education, you might argue that President Biden's talk of forgiving student loan debt and parallel proposals at the state level to increase government appropriations to universities would reduce rather than increase the cost. There's an important distinction to be made, however, between price and cost. It's possible for government to reduce the price of a good, such as a college education, by subsidizing it. What with other revenues flowing into their coffers, universities might charge their students lower tuition than they otherwise would, although this doesn't necessarily happen in practice. Indeed, if we're talking about public universities, governments could even mandate that tuition be lowered. But that would constitute only a lower price, not a lower cost. The actual cost of delivering education consists of the resources consumed in paying employees and vendors, purchasing supplies and equipment, and otherwise running the campus. The great surges in living standards enjoyed during most of our country's history came not from making things more expensive, but by making them less expensive. Invention and innovation allowed us to grow vastly more food, manufacture more products, and deliver a wide array of other goods and services at ever-decreasing cost per unit. It's hard to do, of course, but this is what real progress looks like. And this week's Business Pulse question is, should next round of federal stimulus checks be capped at lower income levels? Out of the 144 respondents, 50% said yes, the levels should be lowered. 27% no, the income levels should be the same as before. And 23% said Congress doesn't need to approve another round of stimulus checks. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. If you have any comments or questions, call us, 919-832-5138. So long.